Captain's Log, Stardate 94577.72. A strange feeling has taken over the bridge this week as our steady navigator has taken leave. It seems there's been a quantum fissure in the space-time continuum as an Iolian rebel has escaped from the lost tribe of the Sith and entered our universe. This usually results in sudden doom, but this rebel, John Jackson Miller, has found the secret that lies in quantum reality. Data, report.
I believe the quantum fissure we discovered is a fixed point across the space-time continuum, a keyhole which intersects many other quantum realities.
So what do you mean by quantum realities?
For any event, there is an infinite number of possible outcomes. Our choices determine which outcomes will follow. But there is a theory in quantum physics that all possibilities that can happen do happen in alternate quantum reality.
Fascinating. John Jackson Miller hails from Iola, Wisconsin. He's just published the Star Trek Prey trilogy this fall. This is his second foray into the Star Trek universe, where he wrote Star Trek The Next Generation Takedown and Star Trek Titan Absent Enemies. Prior to that, he's published numerous titles within the Star Wars universe, including Kenobi, A New Dawn, Knight Errant, and The Lost Tribe of the Sith. He's also been working on projects for the Halo and Mass Effect series, not to mention his own Overdraft series. He's a busy guy. I'm Rick Ryer, in for Glenn Moberg this week, and today on Route 51, we'll travel in and around all these galaxies and take your calls at 800-780-9742. Again, that's 800-780-9742. Do you have a special Star Trek or Star Wars memory or question you'd like to share and ask? Call us, 800-780-9742, and you can use that number in any galaxy that you're in. But just wait a minute. I've been informed our sensors have picked up some rapid magnetic flux variations in our shields. This has caused our signal to reach beyond the boundaries of our geographic sector. In other words, we're live streaming on the internet, and you can find that link on our website and our Facebook page at Route 51 Show. And you can also certainly leave a comment right there, and we'll read it on the air. John Jackson Miller, welcome back to Route 51.
Hey, Rick, live long and prosper here.
Same to you, my friend. The last time you were here was just before Star Wars The Force Awakens was released, and last week Rogue One was released. We've been celebrating 50 years of Star Trek, and you tell me 2017 will mark 30 years of The Next Generation. What is it with these two storylines that gives them so much staying power and multi-generational appeal?
Well, I think one of the things with Star Trek is that it's open-ended. It's more about this ongoing story, this ongoing mission, this journey to find strange new worlds and meet these unknown civilizations. Whereas Star Wars is much more obviously about a conflict, which is right there in the name, it also is about a family, one family's journey through it. To a degree, at least as we've seen in the movies and the TV shows. Whereas, again, in Star Trek, we can leap ahead several generations to a new crew. And also, as we've seen with the movies, we can even leap into another dimension, another reality where we can sort of replay events differently and take it from there. And so, I guess I would say sort of the toolkit for the storyteller is a little bit more robust in terms of the kinds of stories that you can tell and the many different ways that you can sort of adapt Star Trek to different kinds of experiences.
Well, you mentioned something about storyline, and my producer wanted me to ask you a stereotypical public radio question. So here we go. Looking at the narrative and plot development, now, do you see Joseph Campbell's hero's journey as a driving force in the enduring qualities of the main characters in Star Trek and Star Wars? Do you use that?
Star Wars, it's definitely more born into the DNA of it, mm-hmm. Because George Lucas was certainly a fan of Campbell and of that. However, I think both Lucas and Roddenberry were drawing a lot on both the pulp science fiction of the 50s and then before that to the serials, Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon, characters like that. And so, they have a bit of a different, take going in. When Gene Roddenberry pitched, Star Trek to NBC, it was with the notion that it would be Wagon Train to the Stars, which was, again, an open-ended journey where they were going. There was a show called Wagon Train where, the settlers would encounter something someplace every week and it would be an adventure there. It would be self-contained. And then it would be on to the next stop. Mm-hmm. And I can get in a little bit later more into, Star Trek and how it came to be and all of that. I do really believe that, Star Trek is informed to a much greater degree by the demands of episodic television, particularly as they were in the 1960s. And so while you did have story arcs that continued, at least in the 60s, there never was the sense that the shows would be shown in any particular order when they were rerun. Mm-hmm. So you don't necessarily have what we have today in some of the later series where there are elaborate character arcs that go on.
Well, you just mentioned it. Roddenberry did see this Western thing going on when he first pitched that story and then changed things a little bit, well, a lot of it, put it that way, after he was directed by NBC. But looking back at the relationship between the characters in Star Trek and Starfleet as a whole and their relationship with the enemies, and primarily the Klingons, it seemed to have been an allegory between U.S. and Russian relations. Do you see that as a storyline that kind of fits within that frame?
I think in the 60s there was that sort of Cold War thing going on where they needed an enemy, the Klingons, and then also the Romulans who – people are always going back and forth on who here is the Soviet Union, who here is Red China, what are the parallels? I'm not certain that that's really so much the story so much as Roddenberry saw the Federation as this expanding United Nations, which would eventually bring in other factions, if not as members. As allies, and certainly we see that going on as Star Trek goes forward into the Next Generation. The last act of the original series crew was Star Trek VI, which came out 25 years ago, which released literally 3 weeks before today. Today is the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Soviet Union. Yeah. And that was predicated on the notion of, well, what if the Berlin Wall fell in space? And the result of that movie is the Kittimer Accords, which I get to try to undo in my Star Trek Prey trilogy. But the notion there was that for thereafter, the Klingons and the Federation were friendly, and then later on, they're allies. And as we go forward into the later novels, which extend even beyond Star Trek Nemesis, which was the last Next Generation movie, we now have other signatories to the Kittimer Accords, as we call them, the Ferengi, who again used to be sort of one of the Nemesis species,
right,
that were out there, the Cardassians as well, who were the Nemesis in the Deep Space Nine series.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have, even though they don't actually belong to the Federation, they're still the notion is that things are still getting better as we advance forward and this arc spreads ever outward, and we find a way to integrate or at least coexist as we go forward. And that's very definitely a Roddenberry-ish 1960s hope.
Well, and he was right on the cutting edge of bringing forward the politics of race relations, gender relations, and all of that through Star Trek.
Yeah, I think so. And, I think at the heart of, Star Trek is a bit of a thought experiment that anybody involved in science fiction would kind of look at and understand. One of the keys to making Starfleet possible and the Federation possible is the fact that at some point in there, they discovered unlimited energy. They discovered antimatter. They discovered a way to transmute energy into matter and backwards. Matter into energy, energy into matter. What that meant was that there was no more poverty. There was no more want. There was no more need to do most, as we would consider them to be, jobs, because you could more or less 3D print anything you want just by using your replicator.
Right.
And as a result, right there from the roots, right there from the very beginning in Star Trek, you never hear them talk about money. In Star Wars, you certainly hear about credits or or some sort of commercial enterprise thing. In Star Trek, it's very much more what Picard says when this billionaire is transported to the future in an episode of Next Generation, and Picard has to give this guy the bad news that his bank account is not of any use because we know. I think the line is something along the lines of, "We no longer are obsessed with acquisition. We strive to better ourselves."
Exactly.
And that is, I think, what Roddenberry envisioned utopia to look like. And so everything that follows from that, I think, has to have that kind of as its basic in its basic thinking. Now fans will say, well, there is money in Star Trek. There's gold pressed latinum and stuff like that.
I was going to ask you about
but that. But what it's been established that that is something that we keep the Federation keeps as sort of script to be able to deal with other species that do still have. Capitalist societies like the Ferengi.
Well, let's get into Prey, that trilogy. Now, you've said when you started to write this trilogy that you wanted to create a political thriller with a lot of action. And I think you've really done that just by reading through this. And what I found really intriguing, though, for me, was how deep you went into Klingon society and, for the lack of better word, norms, if they have norms. And it actually begins shortly after a certain incident on the planet Genesis. Would you just take us back there?
Well, in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, Captain Kirk is in conflict with a commander by the name of Krug. Krug is played by Christopher Lloyd from the Back to the Future series. And Krug, in addition to killing Kirk's son and earning his lasting enmity, Krug is the first person we see with a bird of prey, which is this wonderful winged vessel that has these this ability to cloak itself. And it's also with Krug that we begin to see the first bits of the Klingon language created by a great linguist by the name of Mark Okrand for the movie. And so all of this, a lot of the roots of what we now consider the later Klingon, society come from this film. And in my book, I imagine what happened to the House of Krug, what happened to Krug's heirs, after what happens in Star Trek III. I envision a plot where they continue to plague first Kirk and Spock in the original series timeline. But of course, Klingons live very long, 150, 160 years. So they continue to plague the next generation crew, Captain Picard, Admiral Riker, as he's now been promoted in the book series. I am able to confront the next generation crew with its own Star Trek VI crisis, something which is blamed or lain at the feet of the Federation and of Starfleet by the Klingons. Something where we failed to prevent something, and it causes a rupture. I was able to then bring in just a whole lot of elements from all across this 100-year relationship, we begin with a single incident, and we go forward to what almost ends up becoming a Klingon Reformation. By the time we get to the end of the third book. There are three novels here. Book one is called Hell's Heart. The second one is called The Jackal's Trick. The third one is called The Hall of Heroes, which is where all good Klingon operas must end.
And the begging question is, where's Worf?
Worf is throughout this story in the Next Generation sections. Worf is one of the major through-line characters in this. Worf has an interesting history that we delve into. Worf actually suffered this Klingon sanction called discommendation, where for the presumed sins of his father, the Klingons turned their back on him because they felt he was without honor. We actually get to meet a group of people who suffered the same fate, or actually their ancestors suffered the same fate. Worf is able to, try to guide these people. And we ask the question, is this fair to have happen? Because certainly Worf didn't think it was fair when it happened in the TV show.
We have a caller from Plover. Robert's on the line. He has a question for you. Robert, thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me on. My question is I'm very curious. I haven't read any of your Star Trek novels yet. The latest Star Trek novels that I've read were, and I forget the series, but from David Mack. And you're continuing of Star Trek canon that exists within the novels. I'm very curious as to how difficult that is to implement into your novels, because, I mean, when you look at the new J.J. Abrams films, right away in the first film, there's a glaring canonical error where Kirk is stranded on Delta Vega, and when Spock's character comes in, he's able to watch the destruction of Vulcan from Delta Vega. But when you go to the original series, in the episode where No Man's Gone Before, Delta Vega is on the edge of the galaxy, and if anybody knows anything about the galactic map, Vulcan is actually fairly close to Earth.
Yeah.
So, it's for me, who I watch episodes of Star Trek daily at home, I'm that much of a nerd with it. For me, glaring errors like that in the canon are just absolutely, it drives me bonkers. So I'm curious what type of work you do to prep yourself to at least, maintain the canon in your novels.
Well, I appreciate the question. Certainly, this is something that we're all conscious of as we work on these books. We want everything to work, and whether that's just among the authors ourselves, David Mack, you mentioned, a great author, good friend of mine, and with the editorial team at Simon & Schuster, and then also at CBS, which is the licensor that holds control of Star Trek, the TV show characters. We have a lot of resources that we can call upon, both officially published and then also the fans have, Memory Alpha and Memory Beta, which are sort of the wikis for the TVs and the TV shows and movies, and then the literature, respectively. For this trilogy, I had the Star Trek stellar cartography maps. They're still on my wall. I have an entire alcove of that, and I was using the Star Trek Atlas to deal with a lot of the Star Charts book to deal with a lot of the geographical questions. So just about everything there should be ironclad. I was using for the Star Trek, when it came to the Birds of Prey, that should be ironclad, because I was using the Bird of Prey owner's manual, or operator's manual, that was put out a few years ago. And then for the Klingon dialogue, I was really fortunate to find this wonderful translator, works, I believe, with the Klingon Language Institute, Felix Malmenbeck, who helped me develop Klingon words, which are more or less they fit all the rules for how Klingon words should be constructed. And in fact, literally this week, he is helping me get that material to the producers who are recording the audiobook series for Prey. So again, we do try very hard, and sometimes when there are mistakes, there are ways that we can come back and actually explain, this planet was actually named something else in the original charts or something, and there are ways to, make it look like, oops, we meant to do that.
Thank you, Robert, for the call. That was funny because I was going to ask you a question about how do you work with the other writers in the Star Trek or even the Star Wars universe. How do you have a convention? I know there are fan conventions. Do you have an opportunity for all of you to get together to talk about this so you are keeping within the canon, if you will?
Well, there are certainly conventions, plenty of them dealing with Star Trek. One Star Trek literary convention I went to a year and a half ago to announce these books was called Shore Leave, and that's in Baltimore. We're all in conversation with each other online, and we'll have Skype chats with the authors who are overseas as well. Certainly our editor is keeping track of all of these things. We have a spreadsheet that has the current ranks of all the characters who are in the literary timeline. And that's another fairly important thing to have because I would say that I've made mistakes. Everybody has made mistakes. I've never, in 25 years of publishing, sent anything out the door that was completely perfect. I'm pleased to say that on Prey, this is with the help of many proofreaders and many many of the current readers. Who've shared things with me on the Trek BBS bulletin boards and various other places. We've kept the errors to a minimum, and in almost all cases, they have to do with just a rank that that was not reflected. And one of the cool things about these books is you can reprint them, the second or third printing, and get those corrections in. Course, the corrections for the digital version can go right in immediately.
That's incredible. Jerry on Facebook sent us a note saying that just shared an awesome photo of his Star Trek Christmas tree.
Oh, wow.
And he says it includes every Star Trek ornament made by Hallmark. And you know what? We have one right here in the studio as well. It's probably not as impressive as Jerry's, but I know you took a picture of it, John.
I'd like to mention that one of the employees for Hallmark, who is often promoting these Star Trek things, is Kevin Dillmore, who is one of the Star Trek authors.
Really?
And so I see him at many conventions where he's working in his Hallmark capacity, but we're also able to he writes the novels with another great writer named Dayton Ward.
Hence the great detail in a lot of these ornaments. We're talking with John Jackson Miller. John is a writer from Iola. John has finished a trilogy called Star Trek Prey. And we're talking with him today on Route 51. You can join the conversation at 800-780-9742. Again, that's 1-800-780-9742. We're streaming as well online. You can get that link on our Facebook page where you can also leave a comment. And we'll read it on the air. We'll be back right after this.
It's been a long road getting from there to here. It's been a long time, but my time is finally near. I will see my dream come alive at last. I will touch the sky, and I'm not gonna hold me down. No, they're not gonna change my mind. Cause I've got faith of the heart. Go where my heart will take me.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Nothing will stand in the way of the Empire.
I was trained to fight, not to stand down.
Light it up.
All right. Get started.
You're all rebels, aren't you?
All the way.
Save the rebellion!
We're back with John Jackson Miller on Route 51. John is an author from Iola, Wisconsin. He's written for Star Wars, Star Trek, and many more things, and we'll be talking about that in just a little bit. What you heard is just a trailer from Rogue One, a Star Wars story, which was released last week. And John, it's an incredible film. What are your perspectives on that?
Well, it's one of those things, living in northeastern Wisconsin, I actually have not actually gotten out to see the film yet because we got snowed in last weekend. And now that I can finally get out of my driveway, my kids don't want me to go see it without them. So we will take care of that. Rogue One is the first of what they would call these anthology films, which are inspired by or set between the Star Wars movies. It tells the story of how the Death Star plans came to be in the hands of the Rebellion, and gives you sort of that immediate prequel kind of backdrop to the events of Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope. That is one of the things that we've been doing with the, as we first call them, the expanded universe stories in Star Wars for, almost 40 years, which is taking moments that were referred to or, merely implied by the Star Wars movies and then building an entire story around them. And because of, the way they're doing things now at Disney with the Lucasfilm Story Group, they're able to take a story like that and really connect it, fuse it with things that they have going on, not just, for example, in, the other Star Wars episode movies, but also they're able to draw on some things in, the Star Wars Clone Wars and Rebels cartoon series. And then the Rebels cartoon series is actually also going to be, drawing on some things from Rogue One. And of course, all the literature is drawing on everything. James Luceno, my good friend, just wrote a novel called Catalyst, which is a prequel to Rogue One. Every one of these things has sort of official clues or Easter eggs or things that are about things that are about to happen.
And when you say expanded universe, it literally is an expanding and expanded universe. And one of the things that in preparing for today, listening to the music, which really does pull out not only in Rogue One, Star Trek, and in many films, that music just adds such a great layer to what you're experiencing in the theater. But this particular film was scored by Michael Giacchino. He is the same person who composed Star Trek Beyond and a number of other Star Trek films. So you're kind of in the same situation with Michael, in that you're traveling between both universes, and your brain is kind of going back and forth. How do you keep things straight?
Well, one of the things I used to joke about was that only guys with the initials JJ were able to work for both Star Wars and Star Trek. But the fact is, that was never true. Just among my contemporaries, Christy Golden has written for both Star Trek and Star Wars. Peter David, quite a lot of other people have done this. You always had people going back and forth. And then certainly on the, behind the camera side, you have Industrial Light and Magic getting involved in the Star Trek movies following the first one. I have to say, whenever people talk about the conflict or whatever, I either quote Darth Vader, "There is no conflict," or I quote Spock and the Vulcans, "Infinite diversity in infinite combinations," because it might have been a thing back in the 70s, not really so much the 70s, but in the 80s in fandom, that there was a sort of schism between the two groups. But I don't think it was ever that much of a thing. I think one of the things that helped was that we had that downtime for Star Wars in between, Episode 6 and then the re-release of the movies much later. That gave a lot of people, myself included, time to get into the next generation and have our own sort of experience like people had back in the 60s of watching a Star Trek series come along. Now it's really all of us against the Twilight fans, or all of us against the Harry Potter fans, sure, or whatever other thing is competing in the in sort of the pop cultural mind space.
What has your experience been as a fan and with fans being regarding loyalties between Star Trek and Star Wars, preferences one over the other.
Yeah, you know, there are people who certainly prefer one to the other, in part because of, in one sense, their professional leanings. Star Trek has a lot of people that are, scientists and engineers and people who got into that sort of thing in part because they were inspired by Star Trek. I think I've mentioned here before that there are sorts of stories that I would not try to tell in a Star Wars situation, because they would be heavily science involved, where science would be more than just in the background. It would actually be a plot point. How the transporters work or something like that would be something that we would delve into. And, we might not delve into it with actual scientific rigor or accuracy, but at least we would try to keep our own rules our own rules consistent. And I think that is something that kind of viewer and reader values. I think in general, probably the Star Trek fan may be a bit older. Star Wars certainly, and of course being owned by Disney, has sort of an on-ramp where the very young can get into it, with the action figures and everything, just mm-hmm. right from the start. Mm-hmm. And so there's a bit of a different aspect there. But, it's one of those things where it's almost like answering, what do you prefer, chicken or beef? I mean, it's entirely possible to be a fan of both.
Well, I asked you that question as a setup, and okay. You have not heard this, but we've actually asked this question to some fans in Stevens Point. And here's a montage that was produced by our intern, Eli Frieders.
My name is Chad Fisher. I'm the owner of Tech Lounge, located at 1036 Main Street, downtown Stevens Point, Wisconsin. I've always kind of leaned towards Star Wars. I like that everything is breaking down constantly, never working. It's kind of a piece of my life. And Star Trek, everything's too clean. Yeah, I'm opposed to Star Trek. There, I said it. Except they've got great storylines.
My name is Chris Randazzo, and I own Galaxy Comics, Games & More in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. I find that Star Wars resonates a bit more for me, but I really find that might be more my childhood nostalgia. There were early opportunities for me to see those movies, have those toys, play with them, and I find the newer movies still tap into that feeling. That childhood joy resonates with me in the Star Wars movies in a way that it really doesn't so much on the Star Trek. Maybe it's because I'm just the wrong generation. I'm kind of in between the Star Trek TV shows. Though I will admit I still get a chill whenever they play that music at the beginning of the movies for Star Trek stuff. All about Star Trek 2.
Space, a final frontier.
Adam DeMarco. I'm the owner of Out of the Box Hobby, and watched Star Wars a lot more when I was a lot younger. Star Trek is more of a science fiction, Star Wars is more of a science fantasy. I never got into Star Trek when I was young, and I still haven't now.
My name is Cassandra Schultz. I am a major Trekkie and co-host of 90FM's Popcology. It's a universal truth that Star Trek is superior in every single way. There's characterization. Star Trek actually predicted the future. Star Trek invented the sliding doors. Star Trek invented Bluetooth. Star Trek invented cell phones. All these things happened decades before they became actual things. And Star Wars is just pew, pew, pew. It's great. Don't get me wrong. I like Star Wars, but it just... inferior in every conceivable way.
Yeah, I'm Jake Juvie, and I manage Gaming Generations. I'd say Star Trek. Yep.
The scope that they're willing to go for, like, the new worlds and stuff. My experience with Star Wars is, like, there's this kind of planet and this kind of planet and this kind of planet. Either it has lots of trees, lots of ice, or lots of dirt. I think Star Trek went a little above and beyond that in regards to the vast worlds that can be seen in the universe.
My name is Hannah Campshire. I am the co-host of Popcology. Star Trek is better, exemplifies the strengths of the sci-fi genre, because sci-fi is about the future. When you explore the future, you're asking questions about the present. And what Star Trek does is it explicitly addresses things like gender, race, religion, politics, currency, government. So it's about cultural exploration, space exploration in every sense of the word.
Star Trek invented Bluetooth. There is no one. You were just talking about that.
There's all sorts of things like that. Yeah, you know, that was great hearing that because it's sort of the pop cultural who's who for this part of the state. I like that. You know, I will say one of the things that as a writer I discovered as, you know, going along, you know, one of the transitions I don't think I've mentioned much in going from Star Wars to Star Trek and back is that. Yeah, in Star Wars, one of the elements is that the characters don't want to be together frequently. You know, these characters are thrown together in an event or a situation that you know, compels them to work together. But even so, there's always lots of bickering. You know, that escape from the Death Star in Star Wars, the original, you know, they're arguing the entire way, and there's lots of jokes. And I tried to capture that in my Knights of the Old Republic comic series, which Marvel is now reprinting. When I went to Star Trek, you know, my inclination was to continue having a bit of that, you know, bickering repartee, and it was suggested to me that, you know, you might have that with some of the other species. That would not fly on a Starfleet vessel because everyone treats one another with respect, and even when you have a character who is clearly a misfit or designed to be a misfit, like Reginald Barclay in the Next Generation series, they all are accommodating, and you know, you don't really have flying insults to the degree that you had back in the 60s, even with you know, McCoy and, you know, picking on Spock. You know, actually, if you go back and watch some of those early episodes, you know, tonally, you know, there's more hostility on the bridge there than you would see in the later series. And again, I think that's part of Roddenberry's notion of, as time goes on, we'll get more used to one another and we'll get along.
We're talking with John Jackson Miller. John is a writer in Iola, based in Iola, and he has just written and released the Star Trek Prey trilogy. Talking about Star Trek, of course, and Star Wars, and we welcome your phone call at 800-780-9742. Again, 800-780-9742. John, being as embedded as you are in this industry, both Star Trek, Star Wars, and your other projects, which we'll get to in a little bit, is it tough to enjoy the films purely as a fan?
You know, it's unusual. You know, I remember one of the most surreal days in a theater would have been back in, I guess it was 2008, where I watched a double feature of Iron Man and Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Iron Man, Jon Favreau had actually used my run on the series to get inspiration. He hired our cover artist, Adi Granov, to design armor for the movies, you know, after having discovered him through, you know, our comic stories. You know, one of the supporting characters in the movie you know, came from one of my comics. And so I'm watching that, and of course, immediately after that, you know, I'm seeing Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which I wrote the comic book adaptation for. So, you know, my first involvement with that had been a year earlier reading the script in a locked room in Lucasfilm. So I'm more or less watching things go by, and it's very unusual trying to, you know, it's one thing watching a movie based on a book that you've already read because you're going, aha, that's different or that's changed mm-hmm. or whatever. But it's very different when you've actually read the script beforehand. And so you're going, hey, where'd that line go? Or something like that. I will say that this is a common problem for, I think, a lot of people who are into you know, series like Lord of the Rings or Star Trek or Star Wars or Marvel Comics or DC Comics. It's become very difficult for us to evaluate the movies as movies. Or the TV shows as TV shows. A film student friend of mine describes it that we're not actually going to go see a film. We're actually going to church. We want to hear the words of the ancient text spoken to us by a different pastor who might hit on different things. And of course, canon, of course, where's that word come from originally? It's got that biblical connotation. We find ourselves coming out of the theater, not discussing how great the movie was, but whether they actually hit all the highlights that we wanted to see or told the story the way they wanted. I think I realized that first after I'd seen the movie Watchmen. And I realized after watching it, I couldn't remember whether I liked the movie. I could only, all of my first thoughts were, well, they changed this, they changed that. Again, I think these kind of serve a different purpose for those of us who are in the fandom.
Okay. John, you are a storyteller. There's no question about it. And you've written and you've adapted your stories to comic books, to novels, traditional novels like the Prey trilogy, graphic novels, and so on. How do you decide when you're putting a story together? How do you decide which platform to use? What's going to best tell the story?
Well, in large measure, when we're talking about tie-in fiction or tie-in games or tie-in video games, the project may exist in some form before you arrive at it. You may be contacted by an editor. In the case of Prey, my Star Trek editor asked if I was interested in doing a novel, and I said, I've got an idea, but it's so big it's going to require your entire fall season. And in fact, these novels have come out monthly and in what is actually real time in the Star Trek universe. It depends on what the producer, the license holder, is actually looking to put out there. Doing something on my own, I would have a lot more freedom of deciding, well, this should be a video game, this should be a role-playing game, this should be a novel, this should be a comic.
You can join the conversation at 800-780-9742. Do you have a favorite memory of Star Trek, Star Wars? You have a question for John about any of his work, and we'll be getting into more of that in just a bit right here on Route 51.
Support for WPR comes from Hooper Corporation, supplying custom construction services, including electric power, mechanical, and green technology to commercial, industrial, and utility customers nationwide. Hooper Corporation, a Wisconsin company since 1913. Support also comes from Christine Bremer Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-law.com.
We're back on Route 51 with John Jackson Millen. Your opportunity to ask John a question about Star Trek, Star Wars, or anything else that he's written and been involved with at 800-780-9742, or you can leave a note on our Route 51 Facebook page. Music you're hearing is from the new series of Star Trek coming up this spring called Star Trek Discovery. It'll be on CBS and CBS All Access. What's the buzz, John?
Well, again, this is another attempt to start a new Star Trek storyline on TV. As you mentioned, All Access, this is on their online streaming service, although I think the first episode will also be appearing on CBS itself. Not the first time they've done this. They actually tried to launch the Paramount Network back in the 70s with a series called Phase 2, which never happened. And then, of course, when the United Paramount Network launched in the 90s, it was with Star Trek Voyager. And I think that's sort of the thought here to get people into the All Access service. This is set some years before the original James T. Kirk run of stories. They've sort of been announcing a bit at a time that cast members. One of the neat things is, you know, the ship design they got from Ralph McQuarrie, the Star Wars artist, from one of the, you know, stillborn Star Trek movie projects back in the mid 70s. And so that's another, you know, fun nod to the past there. And, you know, I could say as well that, you know, there's some connections here to the, you know, the pocketbook's, you know, literature, in that, you know, one of the members of the writer's room for Discovery is, Kirsten Beyer, who writes, you know, the Voyager novels for pocketbooks. And then as well, David Mack, mentioned before, is writing the, first Discovery novel. And of course he's been talking with them about, you know, what's going to be in it.
And from what I understand, the series does not follow the traditional perspective of the captain of the ship, but from the first lieutenant or number one.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to go at it. You know, again, this is, as I say, Star Trek, it's infinitely malleable. You can do this from all sorts of different perspectives, and you know, from Starfleet Academy to the viewpoint of the enemies. And, you know, you could even do an entire trilogy based on the Klingons without too much trouble, because it fits perfectly.
Is that what's next
there
for you?
Well, no, that's Prey. Yeah, so,
that's right.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. Yeah. Let's talk about some of the other projects you're working on. Halo, for example.
Yes. I've done some work in other video game franchises on the comics and prose side before. Most notably Mass Effect. All my Mass Effect comics are now out in a new omnibus from Dark Horse. Halo is published now by Simon & Schuster, the folks that do Star Trek. And I am in Halo, both a comics anthology, a hardcover book called Halo Tales from Slipspace. These are stories that follow the events of the most recent Halo video game. And then I'm also in Halo Fractures, with several other Star Wars authors, including the previously mentioned Christy Golden and also Troy Denning, who's also from northern Wisconsin, I believe.
No kidding.
And these are all short stories that are set from various parts in the Halo timeline.
And a little bit more about Mass Effect. Anything coming up for that?
Well, there's a new game coming out for Mass Effect, but this is the first time that my first three graphic novels have been all out together. No, there's actually one more license that I've been working with, and I can spring it
go
on you
it
here. Yes, we have. I have my first Planet of the Apes story in a book called Planet of the Apes: Tales from the Forbidden Zone. And this is coming out in January from Titan Books, an anthology. These are all stories that deal with the original five Planet of the Apes movies, as well as the television series that was on in the 70s, and I think maybe even the animated series. You know, these are this is sort of a hairy toe in that water of Star Trek. Not Star Trek, I would say Planet of the Apes. But it is a lot of fun.
Well, like I said earlier, you're a busy guy. And one of the things, I was looking back at the historical documents of the Klingon Empire, especially going back to Star Trek III and Commander Krug. And a little bit that I found out is that the actual spelling of that particular name of Krug is Q-U-G-H.
That's right.
Which actually means disaster.
he definitely sows disaster in his wake wherever he goes. Yeah, again, that's part of Klingon, and as I say, I've been fortunate to have somebody help me out with that. And you know, all these things will be in notes on I do on my website, farawaypress.com. I have behind the scenes notes on all the novels and stories that I've done, comics as well, and I'll be able to get into all of that.
And we have all of that linked to our Facebook page, your website, farawaypress.com, as well as some other fun things that you're going to be able to find, and that's all at Route 51 Show. And we do have a caller who can be really quick on the line from Wisconsin Rapids. Marcus, you're on the air with John Jackson Miller.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. John, big fan of yours. I am calling just to see if Ezra, Kanan, and Hera somehow show up in the future Star Wars films coming through.
It'll be an interesting thing to find out. I mean, you know, I wrote the New Dawn novel, which was Hera and Kanan's first meeting. I do not know, because being where I am, I'm not exactly next to the water cooler out there in California. but it is at least possible. We've certainly seen a number of characters you know, from literature show up in comics and novels, and there are going to be novel characters, I'm certain, that will show up, and animated series characters will show up on screen.
All right, well, thanks.
Thank you, Marcus. How does that make you feel when that happens?
Oh, that's cool. it is cool. You know, I when I got my first action figures of some of my comics characters, when I saw, you know, the first people costuming as characters that I had created, mm-hmm. That was just an amazing thrill, because I realized how much time people put into these things.
And what is it like to be at a convention like this when that does happen and you have fans coming up all day long? Briefly, if you can explain what that experience is like for you.
It's really cool. You know, I was just at a convention in Florida where I was inducted into the what they call the 1701st Fleet, which is the you know, Star Trek equivalent of the 501st you know, Stormtrooper organization. But I think a lot of it is really the kids. I mean, I've done library events, and I do a number of library events all across Wisconsin and bookstore events. Where, you know, you're able to actually use these characters and these franchises to get kids into reading and older adults as well. So I being able to use sort of that passport to the other galaxy or other universe to be able to do that is a wonderful thing.
Thank you, John. I want to thank our guest, John Jackson Miller, for being with us today. His new series trilogy is called Star Trek Prey, in bookstores everywhere. Today's production could not have been done without our on-air producer, Jana Rose Schleiss, and production intern, Eli Frieders. Special music today from Alexander Courage, Jerry Goldsmith, Dennis McCarthy, Diane Warren, Michael Giacano, and Maynard Ferguson. Next week, Glenn is back, and we'll have our annual Year in Review program. Until then, live long and prosper, and may the Force be with you.